Welcome to the War in Ukraine update from Kyiv podcast.
I'm Jessica Ganauer, a lecturer in international relations at Flinders University in Australia, and I'm very pleased to be speaking today with Liam Collins, a retired colonel of the US Army who served in the military for 27 years. Liam is founding director of the Modern War Institute at the United States Military Academy West Point and executive director of the Madison Policy Forum. Liam also, related to the issues that we're going to discuss today, served for 2 years as defense advisor to Ukraine. Liam has written numerous articles and analysis on issues related to modern warfare, including in the domains of counterinsurgency, great power conflict, and hybrid warfare. And I very much recommend that listeners check these out. I'll put a link to those in the show notes. So I look forward to the discussion. Thanks for joining me today, Liam.
Thanks for having me.
Before we focus on Ukraine itself, we know that the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine was not Russia's first foreign military venture in recent years. I know that you've closely studied the Georgia-Russian War of 2008. So can you tell us a bit about what we can learn from Russia's performance in that conflict for Russia's battlefield capabilities and strategy?
Yeah, Jessica, I'm glad you started there because too often I think people just look at 2022 and we start in February. And typically when I talk about Russia in 2022, I start with 2007 or 2008 with the Russia-Georgian War. So that's a great place to start. And so I'm not going to summarize the whole war, but really kind of focus on what were some of the things that Russia took out of that conflict. And the first one I think really was that a large overt military force is not the way to conduct a war because it just telegraphs to the world it's an invasion. They tried to sell it as a responsibility to protect, right, South Ossetians from Georgian genocide. But by and large, the international community didn't believe it. They saw it for what it was and really was, from the Georgians' perspective, a preemptive war against Russia, who was lined up on the border and ready to come across. Georgians were just executing the war on more favorable terms. Nonetheless, it was a short war, 5 days. I mean, Georgia is an extremely small country. They only have 2 brigades because 1 brigade was supporting overseas operations. But at the tactical level, one of the things that Russia really saw that it underperformed, right? It just had overwhelming combat power, so it was going to succeed. And it only lasted 5 days. But right, they learned, right, oh, this hierarchical, rigid hierarchy doesn't work. Conscript army is a bad army, right? Rigid orders don't work. And so they really went to, you know, they took a hard look at what they did there and really learned from that experience and executed 2014 invasion of Ukraine to perfection. And one of the reasons is they didn't necessarily need to employ that large force. But nonetheless, when you hear the term of battalion tactical groups, that came out of 2008 war, right? They saw we needed a more nimble, a more fluid, more capable force that can execute operations, which obviously they haven't done in the current conflict. But that was one of the things they learned. So at that level, right? They doubled down on their information operations, really focused on this because they kind of lost that in that conflict. And it always amazed me how I could travel anywhere in the world and see RT on any TV or any international hotel has RT. I'm like, this is pure and simple Russian propaganda. This is not a news network. Why are we showing this in with the current war, right? Those are turned off in a lot of places, but that shows you like where Russia invested, right? They invested in their electronic warfare and their cyber capabilities, right? Mm-hmm. Really to focus on severing, just like they did in Georgia, sever the command and control, right? Sever Tbilisi, the capital, from the troops in the field so they don't know what to do. And again, in 2014, executed all these to perfection, right? Went and seized radio towers, communications, anything so they could establish an information monopoly. Electronic warfare, sever the capital from the troops in the field in Crimea or elsewhere so they didn't know what to do. And again, little green men, right? Because you can deny who those are. And it's not really for Russian plausible deniability. It's for Western leaders so they can pretend they don't know who the little green men are, even though they knew who they were. But it gave them the ability not to act. And so that's kind of the big lessons that Russia took out of the 2008 Russia-Georgian war that the West really didn't focus on because we were at that time kind of coming off of the surge in Iraq and still focused on Iraq and kind of everything else was Afghanistan. And so we really ignored and didn't study it. The big lessons to be taken from that is, again, the conscript army isn't good in the, you know, reforming in the battalion tactical groups.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting. And I have a couple of questions off the back of that. But one thing that really surprised me with Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February was that they did seem to be quite successfully executing this more hybrid warfare strategy where they had some kind of plausible deniability. So Western countries were not responding as severely as we've obviously seen them do since the full-scale military invasion. So my two questions are, number one, big and difficult question, but why do you think Putin's regime or Russia actually decided to shift to that full-scale direct military confrontation strategy when it seemed like they were being quite successful at their less direct strategy? That's number one. And then I guess I'm also wondering, why have we seen them fail relatively in their battlefield performance in Ukraine if they were supposed to have learnt these lessons from their previous military conflicts, such as in Georgia?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like every lesson learned in 2008 and 2014, they just threw away. And I'll explain reasons of why that might be the case. I think if you look at 2014, right, wildly successful, took Crimea without firing a shot. I think, you know, that was clearly a war plan that they executed perfection just when the opportunity presented itself, dusted it off. And I mean, pure perfection. Donbas, a little more of a target of opportunity, supporting separatists out there. Much smaller scale Russian support to that. They did send formations across the border, but really at a much smaller level. And so they were more or less deniable and should have been plausibly deniable, but they were able to kind of deny significant involvement in that. And in this one, it was the opposite, right? It was like their information operations weren't going to be effective because they were telegraphing to the world months in advance they were going to invade. And it's really tough to deny. So that stuff might work at home, but it's not going to work anywhere else. It's just not credible. I actually didn't believe it until 2 weeks before the invasion that it was going to happen. I just thought it was, hey, they were just, you know, some kind of a bargaining and you got to have, right? It can't be cheap talk, right? You have to have skin in the game to demonstrate something. So I figured that's what it was until 2 weeks prior. And I was like, no, they're going, mm-hmm. This is real. And the only thing I can come up with is why they would do it is, you know, after 8 years, right? Ukraine was not going to join NATO, not with contested space. And that's really their strategic objective, was preventing Ukraine from joining NATO, which was not going to happen as long as you have this simmering conflict in the Donbas. So again, strategically, when you look at it from a Western perspective, what does he have to gain by the invasion? Absolutely nothing in terms of that when you're thinking about Russia. But when you think about Russia, you have to think about the regime, not about the country. And when you're thinking about maintaining the regime is the number one priority. And that is not the case in most liberal democracies. And so when you look at it that way, after 8 years, yeah, Ukraine's not close to joining NATO, but you have this thriving, you know, liberal democracy, maybe not as liberal as other places, but in Ukraine, and a capitalist economy, again, higher level corruption than other, you know, liberal democracies. But still, you have this on the border of Russia where you kind of see, hey, what's Ukrainian, what's Russian going back historically? They're very similar. And that is a threat to the Russian regime. And so maybe the thinking was after 8 years, hey, maybe we aren't going to be wildly successful, but we have to go and execute this. And so I think that might give you reason of why they would do it. Still, it doesn't explain what is apparently clear, that they had absolutely no strategy to actually execute this if Zelensky didn't immediately capitulate, which was the case. But if you look, why did he believe he would be successful is again, look, 2014 took Crimea without a shot, right? I'm pretty convinced Western leaders told Ukraine, hey, just we'll get this back diplomatically, which wasn't the case. You know, Russia looked at the Ukraine military in 2014 and it was in a decrepit state. They obviously didn't bother to look that Ukraine's been reforming the military over the last years and didn't believe that this training and these reforms were actually taking hold. And so they underestimated the Ukrainian capability, overestimated their own capability, right? Because they had learned from 2008 and reformed their military, so they thought. And then if you look, right, other things that factored at the kind of the geopolitical level, the U.S. and Biden look weak by how we left Afghanistan. Zelensky had extremely low popularity ratings. And the sanctions that he took for 2014 really were effectively a slap on the wrist. So when we're threatening, you know, swift and severe sanctions, there's no reason for Putin to believe that would actually be the case. And so I think that kind of, from the Russian perspective, explains why they decided to invade in 2022, when most analysts just looked at it and said, strategically, this is a bad idea and there's nothing to gain.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And if we think of the sort of psychological cognitive biases that can operate as well, and that leaders can have a tendency to overestimate their own capacity for military success and underestimate what they're up against or misunderstand fundamentally their counterpart. So shifting to Ukraine, you mentioned that there were a lot of military reforms that took place post-2014. And I know that you yourself were in Ukraine for some of that period and involved in an advisory capacity regarding those reforms. What were the key factors that were reformed in the Ukrainian Defense Forces post 2014?
As you mentioned, so I went for back and forth for 2 years, back and forth to Ukraine, and talking to anybody from their president, who was President Poroshenko at the time, Minister of Defense, Chief of Defense, all the way on down, you know, tons of different, you know, hundreds of meetings over there over the 2 years. And they, I'll tell you, they were clearly incentivized to reform, right? And reforms are difficult. In any organization, trying to reform is very difficult. But I can tell you, their president, their Minister of Defense and Chief of Defense, they were not worried about reforming for the conflict in the Donbas. They were deathly afraid of a large-scale Russian invasion, and this incentivized them to make reforms. Even though the West and every, you know, most people in the policy community in the U.S. and even our own Defense Department didn't, you know, we were assisting them with reforms, but most of them viewed it as a kind of a standard security force assistance mission and didn't really understand it's fundamentally different from a security force assistance mission in Poland or the Baltics. And so they were incentivized to do this, right? They looked at their performance in 2014, right? Completely embarrassed by it. Volunteers had to rush out to the front carrying their own rifles, whatever body armor, whatever uniforms they could find to stave off separatists that were backed by Russians. And that really is what allowed them to minimize those gains on the east, or they would have lost more territory back in 2014 and 2015. And so they under a comprehensive review of their security and defense establishment that finished up in 2016. And at that time, President Poroshenko enacted the Strategic Defense Bulletin of Ukraine that mandated broad and sweeping reform across the defense establishment, with the goal of them being basically NATO interoperable by 2020. I mean, they wanted to be part of NATO, but really what they wanted to have was a Western capable, highly trained, highly effective force. And the reforms were across, right, command and control, planning, battlefield operations, logistics and medical, and professionalizing the force. And over the last 6 years, we've really seen those, you know, where they come from in 2014 and 2016 to where they are today. And I mean, I wasn't at all surprised by the Ukrainian performance, because I know what they did in the 2 years when I was there. And so their performance hasn't surprised me at all. Now, the Russian underperformance, that caught me off guard as well. I was surprised by that as well, for sure.
Interesting. So if we can just dig a little deeper into that, I don't have any military experience or expertise myself, but I'm so interested to understand more about what are those specific factors on the ground when we're really looking at the sort of battlefield engagement that would have given Ukraine the edge. Like, you talked about a wide range of reforms that were undertaken. What were the specific factors? Is it the way that they're communicating? Is it something specific about the way that they're being trained to engage not only with traditional war fighting, but also the sort of more non-traditional, maybe defensive ways of approaching the Russian military attack? Like, can you unpack that for us a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like one thing, right? It's everything. Just kind of like when Ukraine says they need weapons and someone asks me, you know, hey, what do they need most? I'm like, it's not a matter of most. Almost think of it as, right, everything is necessary. And if you lose one of those things, you fall apart. For the person who doesn't understand the military as well, really what they're capable of doing is executing what we call combined arms operations, right? And so you can have your infantry, right? You can have your armor, your tanks, and your artillery, and you can move everything on the battlefield and logistically support that with ammunition, getting it to where it needs to be, getting fuel to where it needs to be, getting food and medical supplies, and evacuating casualties. And these are complex operations in combat, and they take a highly trained professional force to do it. It's very hard to do with conscripts. Think of it at the small level, you have to train the individual to be competent at their tasks. Then at kind of the higher level, you got to train the battalion to operate together. And then you got to bring in all these other assets, right? The medical and all these other things, right? And so you're training and educating, creating doctrine at all these levels. So what does that really mean on the battlefield at the tactical level then? Okay, so when the Ukrainians and the Russians meet, right? The Ukrainians are better trained. They have the ability to what we call mission command, what the Germans called Aufstrubtaktik. And this is what they learned from 8 years of fighting in the Donbas, is Lower level leaders have to be empowered to seize the initiative on the battlefield. But you can only seize the initiative if you're trained and you have good leadership and you empower subordinates to do this. Right? And that's what the Ukrainians are able to do, right? And so you can have less firm plans, because the reality is the plan, as we always say, is as soon as you write the plan, it's out the window as soon as you cross the line of departure, because the enemy never does what you think they're going to do. And so the Ukrainians are able to take advantage of that because they have this training in this, you know, initiative of lower level leaders. And the Russians don't have that because they have poorly trained force, poor leadership. And so when they get in the engagement, that's why they're getting slaughtered, right? And so they're good at just massing fires at a fixed target, right? Just throwing rockets into a city. But as soon as there's maneuver involved and things are moving, they're not able to hit those targets.
That makes sense. So it's that more agile capability where you've really got that trust in individual soldiers' agency, but that trust has to also be based on hard capability. So a lot of training that goes in behind that, I imagine.
Right. I mean, I guess to equate it, I haven't done this before, so I don't know if this will work. I'll try to use like what we call soccer, I guess, and the rest of the world calls football as the analogy, right? And so think of it as like a normal way, the way you play it is the coach is on the side. They have a plan before they go in, and all the players know where to go. Why? Because they practice. They know how each other play, right? They have a strategy. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine if you did that, but you have almost a bunch of untrained players out there, and you have a kind of a loose plan before you go in. But every time now a forward has to look over at the coach and ask what I should do. And by the time the coach tells him what he should do, well, the Ukrainian's taken the ball from him and moved because it's too fast. The speed of warfare, the speed of the game is too fast to ask permission every time you want to do something. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of why they're outperforming them at that tactical level. They don't have to seek permission for everything. They just act, right? And the Russians hierarchical because their lower level leaders aren't trained and don't know how to act.
Mm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Great analogy. Finally, I want to ask you a question for which there's probably no clear answer at this stage, but you mentioned that you were not surprised by Ukraine's performance on the battlefield post 24 February, but were surprised by Russia's lack of clear military successes. So how do you see the conflict playing out from here? We're already almost 3 months in. We're seeing an intensification of the fighting in the southeast of Ukraine. How do you see this going forward?
You know, it's somewhat speculative. Let's look at the evidence and then of what's happened to date and then try to make predictions about what's going to happen in the future as opposed to going with my gut feel. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at the last 3 months of the conflict, it use that to base what it'll be in the forward, and you look at the variables that matter, right? And most of the variables aren't capable. You can't change the variables, right? When you think about war fighting performance, a function of many things. One is the weapon systems and the troops. And that is the only variable or factor where Russia has the advantage. And every other factor, right? The will to fight, training, doctrine, leaderships, individual initiative, all these other factors, Ukraine has the edge. None of those can Russia change overnight, right? It took the Ukrainians 6 years. Russia's not going to fix its poor leadership overnight. Its poor logistics are not going to get fixed overnight. So none of those are going to change in the coming weeks or months. And so really, you have your force. It is what it is. A month ago when they said, hey, they're appointing this new Russian commander to lead operations in Ukraine, and this is going to change something. And I go, no, it isn't. Mm-hmm. You elevated one person, the most senior commander, and put him in charge of all operations, but nothing under him changes. If it was only your strategy that was flawed, then maybe that might do it. But it isn't. He can't fix any of the other things overnight. And so as we move, what do we see? Okay, Russia is trying to consolidate something. They're trying to get some kind of win out of there so they can walk out with a win. First of all, right, to end any kind of conflict, the sides have to come to a negotiated agreement. And there is absolutely no overlap for that at the present time. Absolutely none, right? Mm-hmm. Ukraine is not going to give up any territory. They never, after 8 years, got the Donbass back, and we're even close to getting the Donbass back. And so they're not going to come to any negotiated agreement that says, hey, we'll put this territory in some kind of a international zone or whatever, and we'll figure it out later. They're not going to go for that because they know it'll never happen. At the same time, Russia is not just going to walk out without a win. And so until someone suffers enough losses, which we're nowhere near that at that point yet, nothing's going to change and the fight's going to continue to drag on. Again, until Ukraine is just, as long as they're able to get their weapon systems replaced by the West that are retreated, they're going to continue to fight, right? Because they do not want to be Russian. They saw what life is like living in Donbass for 8 years and want no part of that. So they're going to keep fighting. And Russia, again, it's not Russia as a nation, right? It's Putin and the political elite. As long as Putin and the political elite want to fight it, they'll continue to fight, even though it's clear like a lot of these soldiers are sabotaging the fighting effort and don't want to go to battle and get slaughtered because they know they're underperforming. So that's what I think, you know, longer term, it's going to drag on. In the short term, right, none of this is going to change. So you're going to see, right, just because of Russia's mass, they're going to achieve some victories, right? The red blobs on the map in some places will expand. It's fluid. But then what we see is Ukraine able to, right? They can't defend everywhere because they're the smaller force, right? And if they defend everywhere, they defend nowhere. So they're smart about where they're defending. They're defending the areas they have to defend, Kyiv, Kharkiv. And once they win those, they're pushing back, as we see. We saw them do that at Kyiv. We saw that do that at Kharkiv. And so I think you're going to see that kind of play out from here on out. Right? It's Russia will be able to make some advances, but Ukraine, because they are the more competent force, and as long as they're able to replace these combat weapon systems and get these additional weapon systems, they'll be able to kind of push the Russians back. You know, as far as all the way back to the border, I don't know about that. And it would take months to do that. And so it's hard to make that kind of prediction, but it doesn't seem any way that this is going to end in the, you know, within months.
Mm-hmm. So not an optimistic, but I think a realistic analysis. And I guess a lot does depend on those weapons flowing into Ukraine as well, because if they have that more sophisticated military capability, then that might give them an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, it's a tough fight the Ukrainians are fighting. And I think I think a lot of people thought they were going to fall within weeks and within days or weeks, but they're fighting very well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your insights today, Liam. I've really enjoyed the discussion and I've personally learned a lot, and I'm coming away with a better understanding of what's happening in Ukraine, but also some thought-provoking ideas I'm going to keep thinking about in terms of Ukraine's military performance, but also what's happening with Russia on the battlefield as well. So thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Update from Kyiv podcast. Thanks to Mr. Smith for our theme music. See you next episode.